wasn't directed at any particular person in the terminal. It was directed at the building itself.
Bomb threats forced the evacuation of the Fairbanks Airport. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, April 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, legislation that would require deeds to feature disclosure of contamination on property.
The information is out there for people, but who goes and looks at our database when you're buying property? I mean, it's not common.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
The FBI and Fairbanks International Airport Police are investigating two bomb threats called into the airport last night. The terminal was evacuated for a little more than an hour, but no bomb was found and no one was injured. Two Alaska Airlines flights were delayed. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Airport spokeswoman Sammy Loud says the terminal was evacuated just after 9 Wednesday evening after a dispatcher with the Airport Communications Center got the first of two phoned-in bomb threats.
We received the threat at 9:04 p.m. and the terminal was reopened and operational after an extensive sweep at 10:14 p.m.
Loud says the dispatcher got a second threat 2 minutes after the first. By then, authorities had begun to evacuate the nearly 200 people in the terminal and launched a search for a bomb with help from Fort Wainwright's Explosive Ordnance Unit. Alaska State Troopers helped airport police handle traffic during the evacuation, which ended after no bomb was found. Loud says due to an ongoing investigation, she could not talk much about what the caller said, except to say the caller did not indicate that the bomb was targeted at anyone or any specific airline or agency at the airport.
I can say that it wasn't directed at any particular person in the terminal. It was directed at the building itself.
Loud says the evacuation delayed an inbound Alaska Airlines flight for about 15 minutes and that the aircraft was parked on the south cargo apron away from the terminal while the evacuation and sweep were in progress. She says an outbound Alaska Airlines flight was delayed by about 30 minutes. Loud says she believes this is Fairbanks International's first bomb threat, or at least neither she nor her boss could recall the airport receiving any such threat over the previous decade. She says authorities have not increased the level of security at the airport as a result of the incident, and she says the FBI is helping airport police with the investigation. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska's legislature is on track to pass fewer bills than in any other session in the state's history. And it's not clear whether lawmakers will be able to agree on a plan to fix the state's budget for the future. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
The legislature passed 10 bills in the first 87 days of the session. Even if the pace picks up, it will likely remain well below the 39 bills passed in 2011, which is the fewest in any year since statehood. Lawmakers haven't passed the annual budget or bills to draw from the permanent fund for the budget or to raise taxes. Senate President Pete Kelly says the Senate is willing to stay beyond the scheduled end of the session on Sunday to work on bills related to the long-term budget or that are time-sensitive or critical. He says the focus on the budget has led to the low number of bills passing.
We're trying to concentrate on this fiscal issue that faces us. I think that's the short and long of it.
The House passed on Wednesday its version of the bill to reduce permanent fund dividends and draw money from fund earnings. The bill wouldn't go into effect until the legislature also reintroduces an income tax and raises oil and gas taxes. Nome Democrat Neil Foster says the combination of bills is needed.
The public wants a long-term sustainable plan, and this gets us a long-term sustainable fiscal plan.
There are several issues that separate the two chambers. The Senate majority doesn't want an income tax. The House majority is seeking higher PFDs than the Senate. Senators are interested in eliminating some oil and gas tax credits, but they don't want the House's increase to the industry's taxes. The Senate is seeking to lower the state limit on spending. The House isn't. And the Senate budget would spend nearly $230 million less than the House budget. The Senate would limit spending. The House would not. Kelly says the Senate passed the bills the majority promised. He says he understands why the larger body has been slower.
We said we were going to do A, B, C, and D, and we did A, B, C, and D, and then we sent it over to them. And we worked rather quickly. Now, by the way, it isn't a fair comparison to call the House slow or anything like that. They have 40 people. It's a whole different ballgame than we're dealing with. The Senate can be and is more nimble.
House members say new taxes are needed to close the nearly $3 billion gap between what the state government spends and what it raises. They also say that the Senate plan balances the budget on the backs of those least able to afford it. Homer Republican Representative Paul Seaton says drawing from the permanent fund should only be one piece of a plan.
The other two components were a broad-based tax, which we all know that we need unless we are going to go into severe cut mode and send ourselves into a 10-year recession. And the third component of that was the oil and gas tax.
Senators say lower spending and an improved revenue outlook mean the state can balance the budget without an income tax. Eagle River Republican Senator Anna McKinnon says she doesn't want to hurt the private sector.
I just have personally a hard time in asking Alaskans to pay an income tax when they're paying a federal tax and then turning around and handing out permanent fund checks.
Kelly wrote in a letter to the House Speaker on Wednesday that the Senate majority wants to focus on a limited number of bills other than the budget and permanent fund measures. Budget-related bills include a motor fuel tax, freezing state worker pay, and education reforms. Other bills would make driver's licenses comply with the Federal Real ID Act, amend last year's criminal justice overhaul, and address the opioid crisis. Lawmakers plan to work through the weekend, although some of their aides will leave Juneau. The Alaska Constitution mandates that the session must end by May 17th. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
From leaking pipelines and polluted aquifers to broken septic tanks and abandoned military equipment, there are more than 2,200 open cases of contaminated sites in Alaska. A new bill that is making its way through the state house would require full disclosure of contamination on the deed of a property before it can be sold. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney has more.
They're called environmental covenants, and Alaska's one of just seven states that don't have laws on the books that make sure contamination is fully disclosed at the time of a property sale. Kristen Ryan, the spill response director for the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, has the perfect example of what can happen without environmental covenants. When a gas station in Anchorage closed and the owners pulled their tanks out of the ground, they found that fuel had leaked into the dirt around the foundation of a building on the property. The only way to clean up the dirt was to remove the foundation of the building.
So we agreed, and this is very common, we agreed to allow the responsible party to leave that dirt in place.
And the state put a restriction on the property that said if the foundation was ever removed, the dirt would have to be cleaned up. But then the site was sold several times, and 2 years ago, another person bought the property who
took the building down, was unaware of the restriction, spread the dirt everywhere, and built a Subway restaurant.
Now the owner of the restaurant has to deal with cleanup on the property, and a covenant could have changed that. There are disclosure laws in Alaska already, but Ryan says they aren't always followed. There's even an online database where the state keeps detailed logs of the types of contamination and cleanup efforts.
So the information is out there for people, but who goes and looks at our database when you're buying property? I mean, it's not common. We talk to realtors and remind them to do that, and title companies and mortgage lenders, but it still isn't a guarantee that that information is communicated.
The new law would allow the state to put a covenant right on the deed of a property. Republican Senate Majority Leader Peter Michicki is carrying the bill this session. It's gotten broad bipartisan support so far, though Michicki says the title puts some people off at first.
Some people in this building get concerned anytime they see the word environmental in something. It takes a few minutes to explain the value that in this case, it's good for everyone.
So far, opposition to the bill has come primarily from the Department of Defense. The Air Force Regional Environmental Office wrote to Michicki saying it couldn't comply with the new law. There are federal laws that don't allow covenants to be placed on federal land. And Michicki says he was expecting to hear from the federal government.
We feel they should be held at the same standard. and we think it's important. And as you can imagine, in this building, a note from the feds in opposition to a bill is not always a bad thing. And I don't say that lightly. It just happens to be the case.
Other states that have enacted similar bills have found a way around the federal laws. Colorado put an environmental restriction clause in its environmental covenants bill. And Ryan says that it's a critical addition to Alaska's bill because most of the state's open contaminated sites are on federal property. The bill sailed through its first House committee on Tuesday, and it's headed into another.
The only roadblock that I see is time. I know of no opposition. It was 19-1 in the Senate. I expect it to be probably 40-0 in the House. It's a good bill.
It looks as though lawmakers will likely extend their stay in Juneau past their Sunday deadline. The Environmental Covenants Bill has a hearing scheduled for Monday after the conclusion of the 90-day regular session. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, I'm Rasha McChesney.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an air traffic controller is honored for assisting a pilot in trouble and in need of an airport.
His parents especially that said, we're so glad that his Jesse is here with us today because of you.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
A fatal shooting in Pilot Station was reported to state troopers this morning. 27-year-old Dennis Olick was killed and a suspect has been identified. Trooper Information Officer Megan Peters says the shots were fired from a shotgun on the front steps of a private residence. A party had been occurring inside and other people were around at the time of the shooting. Peters reports alcohol was involved and Olick and the suspect knew each other. State troopers are in Pilot Station investigating the case. Olick's body will be transported to the state medical examiner's office in Anchorage for an autopsy. An air traffic controller in Anchorage is being honored for helping a pilot land his disabled jet on a remote Bering Sea island. Jessica Earp's quick directions to get the F-18 pilot to St. Paul Island earned her the National Air Traffic Controller Association's highest recognition. Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove has the story.
This is radio communication from last summer between air traffic controller Jessica Earp and a Marine Corps F-18 pilot. Earp was at her workstation in the Anchorage Air Route Traffic Control Center when the call came in. The jet had lost one of its engines. It was low on fuel and the pilot needed to land quick.
You can just tell his voice was starting to go up in pitch just a little bit. He was very, very professional, but you could tell there was some panic there.
The pilot's first thought was to try to land at King Salmon, 550 miles away. But Earp says it was too far and the weather was socked in there. That's when she realized tiny little St. Paul had a runway long enough for the fighter jet, and it was less than 100 miles away. Earp says she told the pilot to turn towards St. Paul.
Yeah, needle in the haystack, I think. The only viable airport in the entire Bering Sea that he could have landed at that day that had the conditions he needed to get on the ground.
We'll save you the anxiety Earp and the pilot, Captain Jesse Zimmerman, felt that day. He made it, avoiding a crash in the Bering Sea or the loss of an expensive jet. Since then, Zimmerman and his family have written Earp to say how thankful they are for her lightning-fast decision-making. Earp also recently won the Archie League Medal of Safety Award. Each of the Federal Aviation Administration's 9 regions nominates someone for the award every year, and there's only one winner. But Earp says the family's thanks for her help is the best reward.
His parents especially that said, we're so glad that his Jesse is here with us today because of you. There's nothing more special than that, to receive something from the family that loves him.
In Anchorage, I'm Casey Grove.
Alaska Airlines is expanding and updating infrastructure in the state. Alaska Airlines Regional Vice President Marilyn Romano outlined plans for the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce this week.
We're getting ready to invest over $100 million, well, we're already doing it, in the state of Alaska.
Romano says the biggest project is construction of a new $40 million hangar in Anchorage.
It will hold 2 737 MAX 9s, which are airplanes we have not even taken ownership of yet. It will hold 2 side by side. And the message that I hope that it sends is that we're here to stay.
Romano also highlighted smaller Alaska facility upgrades, including at 11 rural sites, as well as changes to the Alaska Airlines fleet of aircraft. She says the 737-400 series, including the half-cargo, half-passenger combi planes, are being phased out.
Some of them have already gone. They've already moved out. We don't have them anymore. And by the end of the year, they'll all be gone.
Romano says upgraded 737-700s as well as newer aircraft will replace the 400s in the cargo and passenger lineup. Romano also announced the return of some jet service between Fairbanks and Anchorage, a change driven by flight delays resulting from maintenance issues with the smaller prop-driven Q400 AK Air has been running on the commuter route in recent years.
So what we're going to have is about 8 flights a day. Half will be on the Q400, but half will be on jets.
The in-state changes come as Alaska Airlines integrates recently purchased Virgin America into its national operation, increasing the number of destinations served as well as in-flight amenities like high-speed internet. The acquisition of Virgin makes Alaska the nation's fifth largest carrier, accounting for 7% of domestic capacity. There's more time to provide input on what should be considered in an environmental impact statement for the proposed Ambler Road project. The Bureau of Land Management has extended the EIS scoping period for the more than 200-mile state-proposed mining access route in the Southern Brooks Range. The BLM noticed the start of the scoping period at the end of February. Originally scheduled to run 90 days and end May 31st, the BLM says scoping will now continue until January 31st, with public meetings happening in fall and early winter to avoid conflict with spring and summer subsistence seasons. Scoping is the first step in the federal EIS process. The state-owned Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority is shepherding the road project, which would cross federal lands, including Gates of the Arctic National Park. The road is actively opposed by many area residents concerned about environmental and subsistence impacts. The Alexander Archipelago wolf didn't go on the endangered species list in 2016 after it was petitioned by 6 conservation groups. But the feds and the state are looking at ways to stabilize the wolf population on Prince of Wales Island. In a joint effort, new recommendations were released this month. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has more on how this holistic approach still leaves open a lot of questions.
Gretchen Roffler, a biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, isn't taking any chances. We're standing alone in a dim-lit basement.
So a couple months ago, I ordered a new supply of lure and had it delivered to our office, and it showed up just in a cardboard box, and everyone in the building could smell it.
So today, she's agreed to show me the wolf bait, or lure, away from people. Roffler uses it to count the number of wolves on Prince of Wales Island.
And you will see, it has quite a potent cachet.
Roffler pulls the lid off a white bucket and removes a bottle from 2 plastic bags. It looks yellowish brown, almost syrupy. And the smell?
It's got an odor of skunk. It's a little oniony. The wolves find it irresistible.
So irresistible, they roll on baited barbed wire that collects their hair like a comb. Roffler uses the hair to estimate the wolf population.
Instead of marking them with a physical thing like a wolf collar, we mark them genetically.
Back in 1994, the state thought there were over 260 wolves living on Prince of Wales Island. The animals are tracked using radio collars and flyover aerial surveys. Roffler now uses the hair snare method, and her team's last count places that population at about 100 wolves. The reason for the decline? Well, that depends on who you ask.
There's a significant segment of the trapping community that's interested in protecting a local deer population for human hunters.
That's Steve Brockman, a federal employee with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He's part of a group that includes Alaska's Department of Fish and Game and the U.S. Forest Service, agencies that say they're interested in keeping the wolf population on Prince of Wales sustainable. After a year of meetings, the group came up with some guidelines, built around a philosophy Brockman calls managing the ecosystem.
Wolves, humans, deer, and timber.
He says the timber that was harvested in the 1960s left changes on the landscape of Prince of Wales.
A lot of places that were logged during that period have now grown back to dense stands of young growth that really do offer poor habitat for deer.
Which, he says, can mean fewer deer on the island. So the guidelines suggest opening up spots of young growth trees, creating a good place to grow food for the deer. And Brockman says more deer on Prince of Wales could mean more wolves too. Keep in mind, people are allowed to hunt or trap a set number of wolves on Prince of Wales. Brockman says some do it for the wolf pelt, and some do it because they believe they're competing with the wolves for deer. He says it becomes a problem when the taking of the wolves is excessive.
We found wolves dead. It's not that they didn't come back, it's that we found them dead in the woods with a bullet hole in them or with trap wounds or in a snare or something like that and not reported.
Of those that get reported, Fish and Game was notified of around 28 wolf kills on Prince of Wales by the end of last season. The quota was set at 11. Ryan Scott, the regional supervisor with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, worked on the new guidelines with the other agencies. And he says, yes, there are still some wolves that wind up dead. As he puts it, from unreported human-caused mortality.
Certainly there's some level of that happening, but it's not happening at the level that it may have been occurring in the past.
In fact, Scott says the wolf population on Prince of Wales is increasing, from 89 wolves in 2014 to now more than 100. So I ask, is there still a reason to be concerned?
I don't think so. Yeah, they seem very healthy.
Even so, the new guidelines that Scott helped create do call for coming up with a target number.
How many wolves should be on Prince of Wales Island?
Nobody knows. We don't know. And I think that a lot of additional conversation is going to have to happen to figure that out.
But everyone does agree. These guidelines, they're a work in progress. And additional conversations need to happen. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and in the 40 years of Alaska operations. Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
The National Weather Service issued its annual river breakup forecast this week. The forecast calls for a relatively mild breakup, arriving about on schedule across Alaska. But what factors determine the timing and severity and how it plays out? We put that question to climatologist Brian Brettschneider. He told Energy Desk editor Annie Feit the weather and snowpack in February and March generally has almost no bearing on river breakup.
Historically, breakup is very, very closely correlated with temperatures in the months of April and May. So it could have a warm winter up through then, or a cold winter all the way running through March, but it really doesn't have much of an influence on what breakup's going to be like and when it's going to be. So you really need to focus on April and May temperatures, and to a lesser degree, what the snow conditions are like going into the month of April.
So you can have the coldest winter on record, but then April is warm and breakup happens early.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you have a really, really cold winter, you might have some really, really thick ice. And so, just a regular warmer than normal April, it's still going to impact when the breakup's going to be based on how cold the previous number of months were, but really not very much. You know, you could have kind of a warm winter with not really super thick ice, but if you have a cold April, you're going to have a late breakup.
And what drives how that breakup happens?
Well, so when we have sunny conditions and warm temperatures, it thaws the ice, and it can thaw it in place in the river. And it also tends to melt whatever snowpack we have. So if we do have a thick snowpack, those warm temperatures can melt that snow quickly, can send a rush of water into the streams. So it's all about the temperatures. The temperature drives the thermal breakup. It also drives the snow melt, which can push the ice out of the way.
Have you ever used your knowledge on breakup and how it happens to play the Nenana Ice Classic?
I personally haven't, although historically, the best predictor of when a river breakup is going to be, specifically with the Tanana River in Nenana, is to look at the calendar and look last year at what breakup's going to be. And that does better than actually really any other kind of forecast technique. Having said that, last year was a record early breakup. This year will not be a record early breakup. And so picking last year's date would be a losing strategy this year.
Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist who lives in Anchorage. He spoke with Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. If you have a climate-related question, send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. The late Paul John of Tuksuk Bay is remembered as one of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta's most respected leaders. Last week, the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation honored his legacy and his decades of service as a board member by dedicating its new hospital expansion to the late elder. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur was at the dedication ceremony along with more than 100 people who were writing on a piece of drywall.
I can barely write with my cold hands.
Can you just tell me what you read there?
Best wishes.
I just put down Chulunuik Native Village. God bless.
I'm writing down saying good job to the people that made the YKHC hospital.
Jennifer Aguick Stevens of St. Mary's, Michael Jimmy of Chulunuik, and Bernadette Lewis of Trefornik are signing their names and writing messages on a panel that will be placed somewhere in the new hospital building and most likely painted over. But the messages written in black marker by the dedication crowd will live within it. YKHC President and CEO Dan Winkleman, with the help from his team, raised $300 million for the hospital project from various federal, state, and private funders. More than half came from the largest community facility loan ever given by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The project includes building a new primary care facility, renovating the existing hospital, and adding 54 units of staff housing. It's the largest construction project in the region, and when it's done, patients won't have to cross the highway to get dental or optometry care. The added space and funding also means more staff to tend to more patients at the hospital and to travel to villages to provide care. The entire hospital project is dedicated to Paul John, the respected Tuksuk Bay elder who died in 2015 after serving on YKHC's board since the hospital's incorporation in 1969. Gloria Simeon is a current board member who served with Paul John for years.
He would stress that we needed to go back to our teachings and apply them to today. Find ways to apply them to today, because those teachings are the backbone of who we are as Native people. It's the backbone of our culture, and that those teachings should always, always be kept in the forefront of our brains.
The hospital is expected to be completed in 2021. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Tim Ellis and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Andrew Kitchenman, Rasha McChesney, and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Annie Feit and Casey Grove in Anchorage, and Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.